This upcoming concert season will be all about the boots, and Tecovas is your stop for the best in Western style. Tecovas has seasonal and limited edition offerings this spring and summer, including men's and women's boots, apparel, hats, bags, and more. All Tecovas boots are made by hand in a time-honored tradition with timeless styles that are always on trend. And Tecovas has first wear comfort with little to no break-in period. It's hard to find this level of comfort paired with this level of style. Stop by your local Tecovas store, have a complimentary drink or two, that's WCB style, and shop new styles. The smell of fresh leather and friendly staff are at your service. Many stores even have leather custom branding to make your boots truly personalized. And with regular live music and events, there's no in-store experience like it. If you can't make it into a store, just visit tecovas.com. That's T-E-C-O-V-A-S.com. They offer free shipping on all boots, as well as free returns and exchanges, and ship right to your door. Go to tecovas.com and find your new favorite pair of boots today.
At Midway USA, we know the AR-15 is one of the most popular rifles in modern American history. Known for its modularity and widespread use, it's often considered essential to any gun collection. The essential things you need to run an AR-15 are usually always in stock during shortages, things like magazines and 5.56 ammo. Whether you're looking to buy a new AR-15 or buy parts for your modern sporting rifle, log on and for just about everything for the outdoors, shop MidwayUSA.com.
Welcome to DSC's Campfires with Larry Wysoon, the unique blend of hunting, conservation, and the outdoor lifestyle, delivered in an entertaining, informative fashion that only a veteran outdoorsman can do. DSC Campfires is brought to you by DSC, Conservation, Education, and Hunter Advocacy. Hornady, accurate, deadly, dependable. Trigicon, brilliant aiming solutions. Ruger, rugged, reliable firearms. Burnham Brothers Game Calls, callingest calls made. Double Nickel Taxidermy, where hunting memories are preserved. Taurus, maker of the Raging Hunter and other fine handguns. Now here's your host, Larry Wysoon.
Well, good morning to the DSC Campfires. We are in the DSC office here in Dallas, Texas, having just completed one of our monthly DSC Foundation board meetings, and I'm here with the Mr. President of the DSC Foundation, Mr. Tim Fallon. Tim, a lot of things going on, but, you know, hunting seasons are open, and they're opening up almost on a daily basis now. You started hunting probably about the same time I did in terms of age. How did you deal with the beginning or the coming of opening day of the hunting season?
That's a good question. You mean besides not sleeping for about a week before that?
Yeah, that's part of it.
Yeah. Well, Larry, I was very fortunate. Grew up with a father who loved to hunt, and I started hunting at about six. Of course, I wasn't allowed to carry a gun, but just trail along and, you know, be his duck retriever and that sort of thing. A lot of cold mornings in the ice, stripped down naked, so I can tell you. But good lessons learned and very humbling. But no, I shot my first deer at nine, and I was completely hooked. I mean, it just, there's nothing like being in the outdoors, and the preparation you go through, the mental and the physical preparation you go through for opening day or any trip around the world for a hunt, is what it's, to me, that's more exciting than actually pulling the trigger. It is.
You know, in a lot of ways it is. I grew up hunting, grew up out in the woods, essentially, and hunting opening day deer season, even though we didn't have a whole lot of deer, I mean, it was a big deal. Usually there were camps set up around the places, and everybody would get together the night before deer season open, have a stew and tell hunting stories and all those kind of things. And you're right, that anticipation from shooting in your guns, you know, make sure your guns are sighted in, all those kind of things just, to me, were such an important part of everything that we did. It was one of those things that I longed for. I mean, I didn't really care much about football or baseball or anything that you played with a ball, you know. To me, what was important is what I played with a hook and a bullet kind of thing.
Those camps were a special part of the ritual. You know, what I like about today, obviously the camps are a little more modern than we used to have them, sleeping on the rocks, and now there's
more
campers and whatever. But Today, the big difference is it's a multi-gender event. You know, it's in the old days, women didn't go to the deer camp. But
well,
today,
I beg to differ with you.
Really?
When I was growing up, we had a deer camp, a one-room cabin back about a half a mile behind the house. And we'd move into that cabin about, you know, 3 or 4 days before hunting season started. But my mom hunted. And most of the women in that area where I grew up, they were hunters as well.
Good for them.
Serious deer hunters.
Yeah, yeah. Well, the ranch we hunted on as a kid, they had three daughters. And, of course, that was always exciting to be around them, being a young knucklehead as I was. But they didn't do the hunting, but they'd always come into camp, you know, from their house. It was about an hour-long drive across the ranch. And they'd come bring the meals. And it was part of the ritual. But, you know, today, the women are actually doing the hunting, or a lot of the hunting.
Oh, yeah.
It's, and the kids especially. So it's, especially with what we do at the ranch, we're seeing, I mean, 20% of our students today are ladies, are women. And then probably another 20% are kids, you know, and I say kids under 21.
Right.
So it's, which is a great thing. I mean, what does PETA say to a woman who's hunting with a gun? Nothing.
Exactly.
So it's lifelong memories. And you're right. The stories that were told by the old codgers in the camp, and just, you know, as a kid, you just mesmerized. And
Totally. Yeah. I mean,
that's wonderful.
I think one of the things that I really miss about, of course, with the hunting camps that we're in these days are a little bit different, but thankfully, a lot of those places we kind of halfway banned telephones. You know, if it's a family issue, maybe you look at it the rest of the time and you go, "Oops, no."
Yeah, exactly.
As you're turning your phone off as we're talking, which I love.
I just didn't want the thing to ring one.
I can remember so many times of sitting around the campfire and listening to older guys, the older guys being my dad and grandparents are of that era, you know, started hunting back in the early 1900s. And the stories that they would tell, and in a lot of times it was not of the great amount of game that was there, but how hard you had to hunt to even find a deer track in some instances.
That's absolutely true. I mean, people don't realize back when you and I started hunting in our, you know, 8, 9, 7, 8, 9, 10, the deer populations today have exploded
compared to that. It's totally
I remember hunting many days and never seeing a deer.
Yeah.
And today you can't go hunting without seeing 20 or 30 of them around, so especially here in Texas. Yeah, the game recovery is just unbelievable. Of course, you got to keep in mind, you know, up to the 1900s, the deer was a food source, and that's
and they got hammered pretty good. They were hammered, and bag limits weren't necessarily paid attention to.
Exactly,
nor were the seasons sometimes, because it was a matter of survival in a lot of instances.
Yeah,
so much of that has changed, and you know, to me, we live probably what I consider. I get tickled sometimes. Somebody says, "Man, don't you wish you lived back in the 1800s or whatever?" I go, "You ever worn nothing but wool or leather?" And I go, "Man, have you ever shot a gun that you never really knew for sure whether it was going to go bang when you pull the trigger?" And you know, and travel, my gosh, you know, you look like, we talked a little bit, we had a historic gun deal that we just finished where people got to shoot Hemingway's guns and Teddy Roosevelt's guns. It took them darn near a year to go from New York to the to the hunting fields, or 6 months. And now the beauty of it is we can call, crawl on a plane, as you and I have done several times, and within a day we're in camp.
Yeah, you're almost ready to start hunting,
So to me, we live at those, and there's a lot of animals, and we've got the best of equipment and all those kind of things. So to me, we kind of live at what has been and continues to be kind of the golden era as far as I'm concerned when it comes to hunting.
It's a lot easier than it was. Of course, that's the reason safaris back then were, you know, 6 months long, nine months long, like the Roosevelt safaris, because it took you 6 weeks to get there, and then you couldn't drive it. You had no vehicle, so you were had a human caravan of about 100 people carrying all the supplies and so forth.
Oh, my gracious.
But, that opening morning, Larry, there's nothing like it, just absolutely nothing like
it. There is. To me, it's that great anticipation, and I want to come back to some of that in just a little bit, but I want to go back two for the moment. We've done some things about the new hunter program that you do on the FTW ranch, and very recently, unfortunately, I couldn't be there because it was during time from when my mother passed away, but we had the Wild Sheep Foundation, and you had like 11 or 12 ladies there.
12 new hunter
new hunter program
new hunter
how did that go and I'm so I feel really bad about not being there because I'm so looking forward to that one.
I was there on arrival night, and we took the ladies all out to dinner in San Antonio, and then we got them on the buses the next day. And then, of course, I left for Zambia.
Oh, that's right. But, yeah, we'll get to that, too, in a little
bit. But my team was just overwhelmed. It was awesome. Of course, you know, Gray and Renee and did a fabulous job setting this up, Gray Thornton and Renee. And it was sponsored by the Wild Sheep. But Gray got the whole organization involved in it. Each of the chapters sponsored ladies. And
really?
Ladies were given lots of really nice gear, and they were offered a chance to buy the gun that was, you know, given to them by Weatherby and with the Leica optics. And it was, and so really it's 2 days of training, and then day three and four we start, you know, doing hunting in the morning and hunting in the evening, and then we do, you know, you come in and teach typically. Normally you come in and teach a necropsy class and how to cape the animal and how to determine what the animal's eating and where they're living. And then we do a trailing class, as you know, and then we bring in a professional wild game chef, and he teaches them how to actually debone the meat and how to properly cut the meat so you get the most tender part of it. And then what to cook with the meat, which is so important, and then how to cook it. And then we make sausage. And so it's, a person can come in and know nothing about shooting a gun and hunting to leaving, you know, I think I can do this. And then we teach them how to get into hunting where they live. In other words, you know, there's some good approaches and there's some approaches that aren't so good. And, you know, talking to Billy Bob, you know, about hunting with a Coors Light can at night with a spotlight is not the way to get started.
In fact, it's not the way to do it at all. It's a great way to meet the local game.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
Under bad circumstances.
Yeah, and you know, that's a list you don't want to be on.
No.
But it, show them, you know, how to go to your local organizations, go to your local game departments, talk to them about public land or and how to talk to a private landowner. We take them through all that. And it's just a wonderful program. You know, it's funny. I expected to have two or three of them last year. We ended up with seven.
Yes.
Or this year, I should say.
Yeah.
So it's growing in popularity, and which is wonderful.
I can't see that, but just increasing in terms of people wanting to go as the word starts really getting out. And I know that Safari Classics have done a little bit on it, and of course we've done some other things on it as well, too. Interestingly, it is a new hunter program, but I'll tell you what, you know, I've often said this. I've been to the FTW Ranch, Lord knows how many times, but every time I've been there, I've learned something. And I think this program, too, is very much the same way. And I know that there were some people there when I was there who had done some hunting. But then there were also some people there whose maybe their spouse was there under the program. And they were there kind of as a special guest. And I think they learned a lot as well, too.
They did. That's something I did not expect when we developed the program. One of the first gentlemen on the first course, you remember it well, you were there teaching, had been to Africa 8 times. And he was just ecstatic with what he was learning. I mean, just because you've hunted in Africa 8 times doesn't mean you know how to debone the meat, how to process the meat, how to trail. You know, in Africa, you've always got a tracker and a professional hunter and so forth.
Yeah, there you just follow them.
Yeah, exactly.
Not looking at the ground or
anything. So he got to learn everything from soup to nuts, and he was just absolutely ecstatic. In fact, he's going to bring his kids through it this next year. So, yeah, there's lots of really neat nuances about it, and it's extremely successful. You know, as I tell everybody, there's only two good things came out of COVID, and that's 8 million new gun owners and 1.1 million new hunting licenses sold. So, and I think it was a wake-up call for people to realize, you know, geez, oh, Pete, the grocery stores don't have any meat. Can I feed my family? And so, and their uncle may have hunted, or their, you know, their grandfather may have hunted, and they're not opposed to it, but they want to learn how to do it.
Yeah, that to me has been one of the really positive things that have come out of this, and I think a much greater understanding that food doesn't necessarily come from the grocery store. That's maybe not the end product, but that's they've learned that you're right. There are times they weren't a whole lot of meat.
And we've talked about this. Yeah, and we've talked about this before. One of the major issues we hunters face, or conservationists, I should say, because that's really what we are.
Absolutely.
Most of the world is totally, completely removed from its food source. I mean, they literally think a piece of chicken on a Chick-fil-A sandwich just bounces out of a factory. And that,
exactly.
No, there's a bird that had to die to make that sandwich. And a lot of people just don't get that. And that's the problem. Not enough of us are growing vegetables and raising our own livestock anymore.
Well, you know, I've made the statement many times that all life on Earth pretty well exists because of the death of another organism. And that either directly or indirectly. And a lot of people, I think, are finally coming to realization of that when it comes to food, because that vegetable that they're growing, that's a living thing.
Yep. No, I've actually plagiarized that saying you gave me about 10 years ago many times. It's true.
And it's absolutely true. It is true. It's very true, and I think people are finally coming to the realization of some of that. But the new hunter program is just phenomenal. Now, you're intending to have some as we go into 2022.
Oh, absolutely. I think there's already four scheduled, and I'm sure we'll end up with six or eight again.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah. Fantastic. Well, and toward the end of this, we'll make sure people know how to get in touch and learn more about all this.
Perfect.
You mentioned Zambia. Now, when the ladies came in, you got them to the ranch, and then you headed off to Zambia.
Yep.
Was going to Zambia for one species kind of like an opening day situation for you?
It was very much like it. Little history. I was after the yellowback duiker, which is the largest of all the duikers. This is my fourth hunt in three different countries for this thing. I didn't get one in Zambia. I had a fabulous time. I never have a bad time in Africa. And we had them on game cameras, and we saw them, at night. But you can't shoot at night, so that didn't do us any good. We're trying to learn their patterns, and just had a fabulous time. It's a very, in the jungle, you see them when you see them, which is rare. You see them when they're doing the duiker calling.
Yeah, which is almost like a predator call.
Yeah, but it's with their fingers and their mouth and so forth. And so in Zambia, they live in a little more or less dense country, so they have a bigger territory. They're not so much, they don't follow the same trail every day.
But right.
This area that has the permit has only killed one in all the years they've had this concession. And that was completely by accident, not by accident, but they were just lucky.
Right.
Just happened to see
one. Just be at the right place, right time.
Right time. And so we learned a great deal and just had a ton of fun. So I'm going to go back in August and try it again. And, we'll put up some more spotters and game scouts and that sort of thing and try to learn where these things are traveling and then probably build a machan sort of thing and just wait them out.
Right.
Which is the only thing you can do. Of course, when it's dark, there's nothing you can do but sleep or go back to camp. So, but stealth is of utmost importance. These things are so shy. Amazing little animal. They're about, I shouldn't say little, they're 90 or 100-pound animal.
Yeah, aren't they maybe the biggest or close?
They are the biggest of all the duikers. Yes.
Yeah.
Yep, they are. But it's just a trophy that's gotten under my skin, and I'm just not going to let go till I get it. So,
oh my goodness! To me, some of the smaller animals in Africa are every bit as intriguing as some of the bigger ones are when you get right down
they
to
are.
It. And I've been very fortunate, and blessed to have been with you on several different trips over there where I didn't have to pull the trigger because you did, but I was right there at your side when you did it, and it was like me taking the animal too because I was on the stalk and the whole nine yards.
Right.
But again, some of those smaller animals, like an orbi and some of the other many other duikers that are out
Dick
there.
Dick Dicks and the duikers. I don't remember the number, but I think there's 32 different duikers in Africa. That's 30? The amazing part about that continent. It is so diverse.
Yes.
So somebody will say, well, I've been to South Africa, so I've hunted Africa. No, you haven't. That's like saying I've been to Texas and hunted America. That's not true. It's so diverse and so varied.
Or saying I've been to Houston and so I've been to Texas.
Yeah, exactly. So, and as you know, I'm a collector. So, you know, once I've got that trophy for particular, there's three different kinds of sable, there's four different kinds of kudu, there's four different kinds of eland. So once I have that species, you know, I move on. But I'm at a point in my career now where I'm doing a lot of these hunts for one or two things. It's no longer going and trying for 10 animals, which is actually more fun.
I think it is.
It's not about the kill. It's about meeting the new people and the experience in the different countries. And I just love the place.
I've been to Africa hunting and not shot anything.
I have too.
On purpose.
Yeah.
You know, it was my decision. I've also been to Africa where I shot one or two animals. And then I've been on those nights where you go, oh, my God, what's that? What's that? What's that kind of thing?
Well, you remember in 2019, I went 26-day elephant hunt.
Yes.
Walked, we estimated, of course, following it on a GPS, about over 250 miles, and never fired a shot.
Yeah.
And it was one of the best hunts I've ever done.
Yeah.
Of course, the outfitter was awesome, and saw lots of elephants every single day, but we were hunting one single elephant that we saw on day two and wouldn't give it up. And we knew which one he was by his track. But that's the hunt. And that's it's called killing, it's called hunting.
You're exactly right. Years ago, when I was a different person compared to what I am now because I had more time. I was doing more biology work, a little bit less writing, a little bit less all this other thing. But I'd do a game survey on a ranch that I had permission to hunt, and I'd pick out one deer. Now, it wasn't the biggest deer on the ranch, sure, by any means, but sure, I would hunt that deer to the exclusion of all the rest of them. And some years I shot a deer, some years I didn't. Mm-hmm. But to me, that was the hunt and the fun of that particular, of hunting white-tailed deer. It was to just match it with that one particular animal.
Right.
Kind of thing. I've been to Africa. I used to go there with Fred Burchell years ago. Mm-hmm. Came up with the orcs, the golden orcs.
Zebra.
You know, his ancestors have been there forever.
Yeah.
And I'd go over there with Fred and his wife, Laura, and we'd just get in a vehicle in Namibia and just drive across country. And we took two or three tents. We took enough water and enough fuel. And we went across, like, the mid-desert and created roads all over the place. Fred had heard of a herd of 50,000 springbuck that we were going to go find. Well, we found springbuck, but we never found the 50,000 herd, that, although it is reputed to be in that area. And like the last afternoon that I was there, I finally ended up shooting two springbuck, and they were phenomenal in terms of horn size, but I would have loved to have seen what that 50,000 herd looked like. And in the process of it, we got to look at the country that I seriously doubt that there have been too many human footprints made in that, some of that sand that we,
right,
and
yeah,
it was just an absolutely fabulous trip.
No, that's part of the beauty of Africa. You can say to yourself, or it feels like when you're on many of those hunts,
oh, yes,
I'm the first guy to ever step foot in this,
yeah,
place. Of course, you're not, probably
not.
But
I mean,
it feels that way.
But you absolutely, it's
so remote and so isolated.
Way.
Yeah. This last trip to Zambia, part of what I got to do while I was there was some anti-poaching work, and the concessionaire spends. There's no way he's making money. I mean, there's no way. His
right.
quota isn't that large.
Right.
He's got 1.5 million acres. And he keeps a full-time helicopter on staff for anti-poaching, and then he has four teams of game scouts, anti-poaching patrols. And I got to get in the helicopter and do some of the border patrols, you know, the border areas. And we actually found four poachers. They were, quote, fishing poachers. I'm sure when they heard the helo, they jumped their guns. But,
right.
And we escorted them out of the area. Geez, what a... It's a life commitment, and man, my hat's off to him. God bless him. He loves animals and conservation so much, and he knows hunting's the only way to save these animals.
It is.
Because that's what pays for the helicopter and the anti-poaching patrols.
Yes,
but it's a complete life commitment. My hat's off to him. Just an amazing story. Just like Mark Haldane and many of the others over there, they take such good care of their areas.
You know, we think you mentioned there are four poaching teams mm-hmm. on 1 million acres.
1.5 million.
1.5.
Acres.
Okay,
yeah.
Well, that just increased the. I was going to say that's 250. Well, now it's like 300,000, 400,000 yeah. acres, or right at 400,000 acres for each mm-hmm. one of those anti poaching teams.
Right. And what's interesting, he does it where two of the teams are on motorcycles, mm-hmm. and two of the teams are on foot patrols around the perimeters looking for sign that people have come into the concession from
right.
the local
Ingress
villages
into the
and
area.
So forth.
Right.
And, you know, if it was just food subsistence, that's one thing. But it's not. These people are poaching for the horn, the ivory. We found
right.
a dead elephant that had been shot. And just, you know, they're unfortunately, that black market is a very powerful thing. So you're trying to prevent that. You also have to watch the subsistence poaching, too, because the meat, what they call the black market for meat.
Right.
It's huge. Like, you know, they can go kill an impala and sell all that meat in the local village, and it can't be allowed. And so, anyways.
No, it can't, because the unfortunate thing about it is it is totally indiscriminate killing.
It is.
So
is.
You're,
snares,
you're not just taking
else, yeah.
big ones, you're taking small ones, you're taking all yeah. different sizes. And as a result of that, you really destroy that potential for that particular species to continue.
You do, and it affects the predators as well. We saw a lion oh. with three legs.
With three legs.
So he lost his fourth foot.
Oh, my goodness.
Right front foot. Just a tragedy. And he's fine.
Right.
But through an indiscriminate snare. What a shameful waste. It's just terrible. And then oftentimes they'll set these snares, and the next thing you know, they don't go back and check them daily.
No,
they might come back a week later. But yeah,
and
he snared it on day one, and 6 days later he shows up, and the meat's ruined, the hide's ruined, and the only thing that's left is the horn.
Yeah.
So it's just an absolute tragedy. You know, Larry, I don't want to get philosophical or technical about it, but we're in a heck of a mess here. I mean,
we
got 1900, there's 1 billion people on the earth. Today there's 8 billion, almost 8 billion people. They estimate by 2050 it'll be 10 billion, and half the world's population will be on the continent of Africa. That's not sustainable.
No, that
Those
is
5 billion people are going to eat.
Scary, yes.
They're going to eat. And so it's a real crisis. And I find it ironic that the hunters are blamed for destroying, say, the continent of Africa, but yet we're the ones saving it. And the people accusing us of destroying it, or, well, how could you kill an animal sort of thing, have never even been there.
No.
I mean, how can you make a judgment on something like that?
No.
So it's a heck of a mess. We got a long battle ahead of us.
We do have a long battle ahead of us. Thank God we have organizations like DSC
exactly.
and like our DSC Foundation that grants a fair amount of money. I get tickled because you continue to say our job is to give away money so we can make more money so we can make more money to give away more money kind of thing.
Yeah.
You know, it's a continual cycle, and we've been very fortunate and blessed in that we have at least a fair number of people who understand that, who are willing to fund conservation, because it takes dollars to do that. And hunting plays a very important role in that, to have that sustainable population over whatever the species is or wherever it is.
Yep. No, that's exactly right. It's a wonderful program. I enjoy it. This year's grants we made were just wonderful.
Oh, I agree. I agree.
We didn't get to make as many as we wanted or as big as we wanted, but it was wonderful going through the experience yet again. And the impact it has is just phenomenal.
It is. And while we're talking about that, if somebody wants to see some of the things that we're doing, we deal with the Safari Classics, who do just an absolutely fabulous job of putting together videos and projects along those lines. So they go to our dscf.org and see it, or go to biggame.org, the DSC website, and then click on the foundation. But there's a lot of good information about what we're talking about there too on the DSC site as well too.
Yep. Well, Larry, it's been a pleasure.
Tim, I know you've got a long way to drive. I think we have quite as far away to drive right now, but it's opening day is approaching very quickly. I've got some last-minute type things. But what's the best way for us? We talked about the New Hunter Program. Of course, I think almost everybody these days knows about the Sportsman All-Weather All-Terrain Marksmanship Hunter Training that you guys do. If you don't, you can go to ftwsaam.com and learn. And I suspect that's probably the best place to find the phone numbers. And
it is, yes. Yeah,
and probably the easiest way, too.
And it also has a great description of our different programs and the different courses and what might suit you best and so on and so forth. And the good news is you don't have to come in fear of, oh, they're going to try to unteach me the way I do things. No, we're not.
No,
we're just going to try to enhance what you do. And because we're gear neutral, we love all guns, scopes, and bullets.
Absolutely.
We're not going to try to say a thing. You just bring your own gear, and we're just going to make you better at it.
Absolutely. We may try to push you a little bit toward DSC membership. But also, while we're talking about this, too, you offer some absolutely fantastic hunts there on particular species that you can't really go find anyplace else anymore.
So no, that's right.
Just want to touch on that just a little bit, because you do have an unbelievable hunting program, conservation-based.
Well, thank you, Larry. Yeah, with the exception of whitetails, of course, and a few other species which are now pretty common in Texas.
Right.
But we focus on animals that are either endangered or extinct, where they're indigenous from, things like the Bucaran Markhor and the Trans-Caspian Ural and the Nubian Ibex, Iranian Red Sheep, et cetera. But we have a heck of a breeding program, which is really cool because I call it the zoo industry, but as these animals are born in the breeding system, the males will sort those once they're weaned, and they'll go up into an aging system. And many of those animals either get released onto the ranch into the 12,000 acres, or they go back into what I call the zoo industry, which is we deal with three or four brokers that trade in and out of the zoos.
Right.
And/or other breeders perpetuate the species.
Yeah, and to prevent some inbreeding type thing.
Yeah, and you have to mix your genetics up, obviously. But it's do we make money at it? No. But it's part of paying it forward and part of the life cycle, and it's absolutely wonderful. So we have a great time doing it.
You make me homesick for the ranch. Tim, thank you so much for joining us this morning around the DSC campfire. I can't wait till we get together around and not that virtual campfire, but the real campfire next time. Thank you very much for joining me this morning.
I do, too. It was a pleasure. Thank you for having me, Larry.
Thanks for joining us around the campfire. To leave a comment or suggestion for an upcoming episode, go to Instagram at Larry Wysoon Outdoors. Please join me right here next week for another DSC's Campfires.
DSC Campfires with Larry Wysoon has also been brought to you by the Texas Wildlife Association. Working for tomorrow's wildlife today. TRHP Outdoors. Kenitrek Boots for the trails less traveled. Boyt, the finest in hunting gear. Pyramid Air for all things air gun, and Ripcord Rescue Travel Protection.